Well, I am happy to be with you and happy that it worked out that my schedule was clear to help relieve Lorraine in the midst of a really busy period. And I hope that she enjoyed the wedding yesterday, and I sure enjoyed the memorial service on Monday and reflecting on the beautiful life that was Stephanie among us, and I'm glad that Lorraine was free to do that. And one of the tricks that you learn in preparing messages is, you know, what to spend your time on, and how, when you're preparing a message, what is it you say, and how do you allot your time? And yeah, at one point, especially earlier on, I would spend an inordinate amount of time on the title, thinking that, you know, the title would you know, a catchy title will, like, bring people in and just prove how clever and how coherent everything is. And I've largely given that off for probably the last 6 years, not really caring much about the title because, you know, nobody else cares, and it's really, you know, just a few words at the top of the page. But sometimes when one is concerned that the sermon takes a few wandering paths and that perhaps the message goes in several different directions, and it is not, will not be known until the very end whether or not it arrives anywhere, that a title might just be a helpful way to clue people in on what's happening. So here's my title. On Mercy, Commitment, and Being Right. John Woolman's Witness of Prophetic Non-Attachment. And so that is our title. And I want to read Jeremiah 42, verses 9 through 12 for you in thinking about this message. This is the message from God, the God of Israel, to whom you sent me to present your prayer. This is Jeremiah speaking. He says, if you are ready to stick it out in this land, I will build you up and not drag you down. I will plant you and not pull you up like a weed. I feel deep compassion on account of the doom I have visited on you. You don't have to fear the king of Babylon. Your fears are for nothing. I'm on your side, ready to save and deliver you from anything he might do. I'll pour mercy on you. What's more, he will show you mercy. He'll let you come back to your very own land. Many of you know that I have a special and, some might say, inordinate affection for people of faith in ages past, people who live lives of absolute surrender to the voice of God, who walked against the tide of human opinion and in so doing became a foretaste of heaven on earth. And most of all, I have a special admiration for an unassuming colonial Quaker tailor named John Woolman. And John Woolman is one of the most famous of all the American Quakers. He was born in 1720 near Mount Holly, New Jersey. He was raised in a devout Quaker family. Woolman is best known as an early anti-slavery advocate who helped to lead Quakers toward a corporate anti-slavery position. However, Woolman did not see the end of Quaker involvement in slavery during his lifetime. As a young man in Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, slavery was generally accepted by many Quakers. Before 1750, Quaker slave ownership rates in Philadelphia were about the same as the ownership rates in the Philadelphia population as a whole. Over the course of his life, Woolman repeatedly called his fellow Quakers to conform their outward lives to the reality of God's work in them, and for this, he has been called the American prophet. Now, the problem with talking about someone like Woolman is that he has become something of a hero for many Quakers, and we kind of just assume that wherever he went, people were persuaded to free their slaves, and that the waters opened before him, and he changed the course of history. And everybody knew at the time that, of course, he was right, just like we know now that, of course, he was right, and he lived happily ever after. From the perspective of history, we look at his record of monumental accomplishments and neglect to see his own uncertainty and his 30-year struggle to give voice to God's will with mercy and humility toward those who disagreed with him. For some, Woolman's message is one of simplicity. For others, it is one of equality and crossing racial and religious boundaries. And I found Woolman to be all of these, of course, but I've mostly found Woolman to be a deeply unsettling presence, the prick in my conscience that will not leave me alone, that challenges the way I demonize those who disagree with me, and that presents me with a vision of a world remade. What distinguishes Woolman from myself is that where I am tempted to use my religious convictions as a bludgeon that is all too happy to create change through coercion, Woolman did not view truth as something that can be wielded, but as something that consumes one's life, and in that experience of being spiritually and holistically consumed, leads to comprehensive transformation and healing. A transformation that goes beyond the victory of one opinion over another, but is enraptured in a spiritual and social revolution that is universal and eternal. In other words, for Woolman, the prophetic vocation was about being subject to something beyond himself, a message that had as its goal the union of God and humanity and the submission of all aspects of human affairs to the direct and inward voice of God. I have found Woolman's prophetic voice to be challenging and unwelcome because in its comprehensiveness, it leaves me no place to hide. It rejects the compartmentalized way I create boundaries around the places in my life and in my heart that I would rather leave untouched, protected, and hidden. It rejects the demonizing and partisanship that characterizes conflict within the church and beyond it. I am not the first to view Woolman as a troubling figure like this. While we might think of him today as a luminary, a standout, the most authentic representative of 18th century Quakerism, the truth is that in his own day, he was not esteemed differently from any number of other Quaker ministers. Not only that, many Quakers did not know what to do with him, and many found his views and habits excessive. To deal with some of his behaviors, soon after his death, his writings were edited and tamed. Gone were two supernatural visions. Cut out were references to refusing to pay war taxes and his criticisms of the British transatlantic imperial economy. Some of his anti-slavery writings were watered down and abridged. The image of Woolman that resulted was of a pious model of lowliness, self-effacement, and humility, John Woolman, meek and mild, a spirituality devoid of moral embodiment and socio-political transformation. Not all of Woolman's ideas found acceptance in his life. Many of his peers considered him to be singular. To be singular was not a good thing. The label meant that Woolman's views in some areas were not prerequisite to be a good Quaker, and in some cases implied that Woolman was dangerously close to stepping outside the bounds of accepted Quaker behavior. Upon meeting Woolman, one leading British Quaker was not overly impressed. He wrote, "John Woolman is solid and weighty in his remarks. I wish he could be cured of some singularities, but his real worth outweighs the trash." In this particular letter, there is uncertainty whether or not that final word is trash or husk. But in either case, many Quakers thought some of Woolman's habits were insupportable and should be discarded. But perhaps the person most upset by Woolman's singularity was Woolman himself. He knew he held different opinions from others. He knew that people were making all sorts of assumptions about the motivations that underlie his conviction, and it caused him emotional turmoil. Some likely thought that he was excessively pious. Others thought he was an attention seeker. The distress Woolman felt when he challenged the misguided notions of his peers was only mitigated by the intensity of divine revelations that were as real, direct, and understandable to him as if they were given from God in person. Woolman's experience of God's revelatory presence led him to look for kindred spirits in the Hebrew prophets, and especially the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah, known as the reluctant prophet, was a model to Woolman of someone who would rather not be a prophet, thank you very much. Jeremiah wanted his message to go away and leave him alone. He wanted to be just like everybody else. He did not want to bear bad news against his neighbors. Like Jeremiah, the revelation of God to Woolman was one that challenged those delusions of faithfulness and obedience that occur whenever humanity turns its energy into destructive egocentrisms, oppression, and negations of God's creative intent for human thriving. All those corruptions of divine human intimacy that only lead to spiritual and social alienation. Despite the momentousness of Woolman's anti-slavery work, nowhere in his writings does he ever appear giddy to take a prophetic stance that he knows would be opposed by his fellow colonists and Quakers. Woolman was not looking for a fight. Like the prophet Jeremiah, he found the message God had given to him a burden, an exercise, a duty, a solemn calling that brought with it interpersonal turmoil and anxiety. Woolman's genius was that he did not place himself over and above his peers, even in those places where his conviction was strong. Rather, the distance between his sense of God's leading and the apostasy he saw in the world around him caused him grief. He did not lambast his fellow Quakers for their positions and for the oppressive systems they supported. He grieved for them. He cried for them. On several occasions, he was reduced to tears when confronted with hardened hearts. And when he found himself under compunction from God to walk a different path than his acquaintances and friends, Woolman could not caricature or demean those who felt differently from him on the most controversial issues of his day, because he was committed to his community. And he knew that his convictions were not his own, they were given him by God. Since his vision for human faithfulness was given to him by God, they belonged to God, and it was to God that he entrusted them. On one occasion, Woolman saw that he could not push his fellow Quakers any further, and yet they watered down the anti-slavery language he knew to be right. And in a moment of spectacular trust in God, he said, "I felt easy to leave all to him who alone is able to turn the hearts of the mighty and make way for the spreading of truth in the earth by means agreeable to his infinite wisdom." And later on that same journey, Woolman described the type of prophetic non-attachment that invigorated both his obedience to the divine voice and his commitment to Quaker community. "I have had renewed evidences that to be faithful to the Lord and content with his will concerning me is a most necessary and useful lesson for me to be learning, looking less at the effects of my labor than at the pure motion and reality of the concern as it arises from heavenly love." For Woolman, the message was authored by God and so held by God, and its fulfillment too was in God's hands. Attentiveness to the source of divine revelation was the litmus test for prophetic authenticity, and by placing his focus on God's voice, Woolman embodied the spiritual transformation out of which his social vision arose. Woolman was deeply concerned with the issues of his day: high rents and interest payments, poverty, slavery, egregious wealth, alcoholism, the rapaciousness of the British transatlantic imperial economy. But he did not merely have a list of issues on which he took public stands as if they could all be isolated, fragmented, and compartmentalized. Woolman's prophetic voice was a comprehensive and unified whole. Respond to the motion of love. Respond to the motion of love. Respond to the motion of love. By pointing again and again to the spiritual root and cause that taught him what a world remade would look like, Woolman avoided the pitfall of becoming merely a partisan. Like the Hebrew prophets, Woolman saw that the social degeneracies of his day were symptoms of spiritual alienation and rebellion. Woolman's challenge to his fellow colonists was to hearken back to the pure motion and reality of God's will. Outside of a state of obedience within God's will, outside of the complete surrender of oneself to God, slavery happens. Economic and physical bondage happen. Greed happens. Woolman's letter shows that not even his closest friends and allies escaped the unrelenting energy of his commission to call people back over and over to the presence of God and to warn them of the pride that put them in eternal jeopardy. In the spirit of Jeremiah, Woolman was the reluctant prophet, called to a testimony he did not want with a message he would have rather ignored because he knew that his message was one that originated elsewhere. He could only grieve for those to whom he was sent and grieve for the path he must walk. But his grief was also his vindication. He took assurance from the fact that his message caused him angst and was contrary to his own inclinations, because that validated for him that his message was not of his own, but was from God. Woolman's grief grounded his social witness in love for his people, his friends and neighbors whom he often disagreed with. It was a love that believed, above all else, that the apathetic, self-centered stagnation that passed for religion among some of his fellow Quakers was too small a thing and too puny a calling for a people sent by God to be in the vanguard of God's will for human destiny. The prophet delegitimizes and rejects the present ordering of things, while fostering and pointing to an alternative consciousness that energizes communities with its promise of another way of being toward which they may faithfully move. Woolman was committed to his Quaker community, all the while challenging Quaker stagnation with a vision of the world he thought God was bringing about. The core of Woolman's prophetic voice was his consistent call to return to the experience of spiritual light and life, without which Quaker action was nothing more than religious performance. Woolman attacked those practices and habits that hindered the activity of the spirit in the world, that oppressed the soul, and that contradicted the divine intent for human faithfulness. In the Apocalypse of the Heart, Woolman believed the Spirit of Christ would so transform the individual as to show them an alternative vision of society, an alternative way of living and being faithful, a perfected and just ordering that reflected God's ultimate intent for human destiny, but available now on earth through human faithfulness. Woolman said of this vision in 1772, "In the harmonious spirit of society, Christ is all in all. Here it is that old things are passed away. All things are new. All things are of God, and the desire for outward riches is at an end." The social dimensions of Woolman's prophetic voice found cohesion in a vision of a world remade where greed, schism, and oppressive practices were no longer possible because their root cause was no longer viable in the new world of absolute human dependency on God. The more I know of Woolman, the more uncomfortable I am with him, because to take him seriously is to let him question the assumptions I take for granted. Woolman challenges the individualism that preempts true corporate discernment and listening. Woolman exposes the way I replace the leadership of Christ with self-justifications. And most of all, I look at the heroic convictions Woolman had, and I want to be so like him. I want to be the one taking the stand that people will honor. I want to be the one leading the charge. I want to be the one whose voice echoes through the generations. And in that conceit, I make the fatal mistake. For Woolman, it's not about the impact a person has. It's about following Christ. If Christ is the leader, we can take our stand in peace, knowing our efforts are sustained by God and not by us, and that it is God who will establish truth on earth in God's own timing. We can leave all to God, who alone changes the hearts of men. Friends, every generation has a challenge to face. Like Woolman, we are looking with expectancy for the transformation of what is into consistency with what may be. And like Woolman, we hope that what we do now might be a foretaste of the love we desire to become the norm for human walking on the earth. I want to submit to you this morning that the grace and mercy Woolman directed toward his fellow Quakers who disagreed with him was not incidental to the anti-slavery progress that occurred as a result of his ministry. And I want to submit to you that if there was ever a time when people feel justified in writing other people off, it is in our own day. Our yearly meeting is wrestling with important issues of human sexuality and biblical interpretation. And it is to be expected that we sometimes get hot under the collar. The lines in our yearly meeting are drawn just like they are in most every other church in the country. But friends, we are not called to be like every other church in the country. We are peacemakers. We are loudly silent, assertively contemplative, and humbly prophetic. And if there was ever a time that our yearly meeting and our world needed a group of people to reject the rhetoric that divides and the impatience that puts false boundaries around the Spirit, it is now. Woolman's message presents us with an alternative to the discord and suspicion that often characterizes divisions in the church. Like the prophet Jeremiah, Woolman was absolutely committed to his Quaker community, even when they rejected his message. On multiple occasions, Woolman reiterated the conviction that while he did not know how people could extricate themselves from slavery, the constrictions of wealth, and the pride that underlie it all, he had faith that God would provide a way out. The act of resignation to God's will itself would provide the map for change, redemption, and transformation. Again and again, Woolman held up the prospect that the new world God was establishing on earth was one characterized by an intimate and direct hear and obey relationship with humanity. And again, he declared that the path toward the implementation of that vision was to turn even now and respond to that transforming presence. He called colonists and us to become subjects to the one voice out of which any voice that is prophetic must spring, to the one thing that upends and redefines all others and recreates the world with spiritual resources that can only be truly known in a life transformed. Woolman found his prophetic voice in the commissioning that he felt could only come from a divine source directed into human community. Like the Hebrew prophets who remained in community with Israel, even as Israel rejected their warnings, Woolman did not seek to break fellowship with his Quaker community, even when they were dead wrong. What we see in Woolman is that the prophetic voice is not primarily seen in the oppositional positions a person takes, but in the community a person builds. A prophetic voice is legitimated by one's advocacy of issues relating to deeper spiritual growth and by the enhancement of the community in which one has been placed. All too often, this will mean taking the long view, like Woolman did. Taking the long view means finding a place to stand and to have a voice, but it opens the door for grace and community and to trust that the work of truth is ultimately unstoppable, but that it cannot be forced. It will mean turning the other cheek when offended, hurt, or maligned in the course of following Christ. The way Woolman has exercised his prophetic voice is a helpful corrective to my own tendency to be strident in those places where I form positions of opposition to others that I would like to think are prophetic, but that have at least some footing in self-righteousness and my own enculturation. While we don't often associate humility with being prophetic, Woolman and Jeremiah before him are examples of just that. When the prophetic voice arises from a humble heart, it has the power to build community, preserve dignity, and point to the social and interpersonal transformation that is capable of achieving the impossible.